Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What are the consequences of being unhealthy, and by what criteria do we decide who is healthy and who is not? The absence of pain and disease and a strong body that does what we need and want it to might seem universal and obvious characteristics shared by people in good health. But health is not just a biological state. It is also a cultural construct. And when we're perceived by others as making unhealthful choices, we risk their judgment and disapproval. Jonathan M. Metzl is Associate Professor of Psychiatry and Women's Studies and Director of the Program in Culture, Health, and Medicine at the University of Michigan. Along with Anna Kirkland, he is editor of a new collection of essays called Against Health, How Health Became the New Morality. Jonathan, welcome to Think.
Hi, it's great to be here.
We should start by talking about your title, which I realize is deliberately provocative. For the record, you are not against decent medical care or people's desire to be well.
No, we actually make that very clear in the beginning, very beginning of the book, that myself and other authors associated with it, and Anna Kirkland, who's my co-editor on the project, we want to be very clear that we are for medical advances, for antibiotics, for sunscreen, for enteric-coated tablets. We make a long list of the things that we're for. So we are not trying to say that people should read this book and then rush out and not participate in medical care or take care of themselves.
So how do we define health in America?
Well, I mean, that's part of the tension that we're trying to get at, which is that I should say that the people who participated in producing this book are from a variety of different disciplines. So
yeah.
We're coming at this. I'm a physician, as you just mentioned. My colleague who helped me write the book is a legal scholar who works on what's called fats rights. And then we have people from anthropology, medicine, bioethics. And so everybody was approaching the definition of health a little bit differently in the essays that they wrote in the book. But what we started to see as we looked around is that there was a tension in the way that this term was used, which is, on one hand, health is assumed to be a universal good, that everybody should have health. It's a good thing, and the absence of health is a bad thing, end of story. And as we started to look around and really answer the question that you just asked me, how do we define health in America, we started to see in looking at kind of who was defining health and how they were defining it, that it was very much linked not just to the absence of disease, but also to a host of other more ideological or commercial purposes. So we looked at drug advertisements and the use of health in the healthcare debate, and health as a form of bias by different employers, a whole host of different areas. And what we found was that we didn't agree with all the uses of health that were out there. So part of the book is trying to uncover why this is a complicated term.
Well, one of the reasons that it's trickier than it seems is that individuals can appear to be healthy or unhealthy based on what we think that means, but those appearances can be quite deceiving.
No, absolutely, absolutely. And the question of kind of who's judging a person's appearance. So one of the, a good number of the essays in the book actually talk about the issue of body size, for example. And there's been a great debate about body size and the relationship between what we call health or healthy behavior and a person's body size. So again, we're not trying to say that people should overeat or gain weight or anything like that. But there has been, I think, very valid critiques coming from within medicine and from outside of it, saying that some of the critiques linking what we now call kind of being overweight and health are linked as much to cultural aesthetics, assumptions about how those people look, or whether they're lazy or weak of will, as they are about actual medical sequelae.
I thought it was really interesting. In your introductory essay, you point out that men's and women's health magazines seem to be pretty exclusively focused on health as related to appearance. There's not a lot of articles about keeping one's kidneys healthy.
Right. No, that was one of the points that we made. So in the introduction, I kind of go through the places where I think that health is being defined. And what I did in the introduction was basically ask the readers, but also it's an exercise I do in the classroom with my students. Okay, we all agree health is a good thing. Go out and just start to look at where the word health is used, and see if you agree with that usage or not. And one of the places that always comes back is, of course, magazines like Men's Health, Women's Health, Health itself, and different articles in these kind of magazines. And when we started to read through, I don't think it's very surprising that what we found was not, keep your blood pressure down or take care of your kidneys. It was six-pack abs and buns of steel and all these things that were linking a kind of medical rhetoric of health with the kind of cultural aesthetics about how you should look to feel healthy.
And there's also, I would imagine, a certain amount of ageism that comes across in those publications, because you don't see a really healthy 75-year-old man on the cover of Men's Health.
No, it would be great if we did. But no, I think that's absolutely true. That, again, on one hand, our society has moved toward more awareness, you could argue, in certain socioeconomic circles of exercise or what might be called healthy eating. Now, of course, that's not true across the board. But as that happens, we paint different pictures of health, and there are different social pressures that come with that. And I think for a long time, we've been rightly critical in the academy of the pressure on women to maintain a particular healthy ideal through, you know, reducing food intake or being thin or other kinds of social pressures. But what we found interesting was that the profound social pressures on men in this day and age, particularly if you look through magazines like Men's Health and stuff, it wasn't like drink a beer and sit back and eat some potato chips. It really was, there was social pressure on men to have a particular body ideal that was called health, but was much more about the cultural aesthetics of this moment in time.
And no matter what you want to say to somebody, if you couch it in terms of concern for their health, then it's almost like you're blameless.
That's the point that we try to make in the book, is that, again, just to say we're not against surgery or going to the doctor or, you know, getting a checkup. What we're saying is that when people make health claims, they're using it sometimes in the places we look to, you know, it's an unassailable thing because you're concerned about somebody's health. But health is also a rhetoric that's used to convey prejudice. But because it's being couched in health, we can say things against, you know, fat people. We can say things against smokers. We can say things against people. And as long as we couch it in health, it's an acceptable form of discrimination that flies under the radar of what we might call kind of, you know, acceptable speech, that it's acceptable because we call it health.
What makes you think, Jonathan, that it's not just about health, that in fact, if we know that smoking and obesity can be bad for our health, what makes you think that when people criticize these behaviors, they are in fact assuming that the person doing them might be a bad person?
Well, you know, again, it's not across the board.
Right,
there are
right.
definitely everything that I'll say on this program today and everything we say in the book, we're very clear that there, of course, are exceptions on both sides. What we worry about in the book is that these rhetorics are used to convey kind of in-group and out-group in a way. And one example, I mean, again, we're not for smoking, but there is a cigarette on the front cover of our book. And part of that is to say that, you know, in the present day, for example, you know, you'll walk into a building. I'm in New York right now, and it's very cold outside. But you walk into a building, and before you get in the building, you see these little people kind of huddled in the corner outside who are out there for their cigarette breaks. And, you know, because you can't smoke inside, obviously. And so it's a complicated issue as you walk into the building and see these people huddled outside, which is on one hand, you could rightly argue that's a victory for public health. People inside the building are not being exposed to secondhand smoke. On the other hand, as you walk in, you see a group of people who you might say they're bad people. They're bad for all of our health. There's some kind of stigmatizing assumption about these people as being abject, as being cast out of you know, society or something like that. And so, in a way, it's that moral judgment that we're concerned with, that these kind of interventions, on one hand, can be good for people, on the other hand, can create classes of people who are, in a way, second-class citizens.
How is our notion of what's healthy tied into the realities of power and privilege in society?
Well, I mean, certainly that's true historically, absolutely. And in a lot of the other work I do, I've tried to make the case that, of course, there is a power position. Now, a lot of the issues that we're talking about here kind of fluctuate with cultural aesthetics. So there were different moments in time or different cultural contexts where being what we would call now obese was a sign of power or authority because you had access to food or nutritional, you know, things. So it's not like, you know, it's not like our cultural mores now are true across time. But of course, there is a power dynamic that we're trying to at least call into question. And one place that we talk about in the book is about definitions of health, comparing people who have access to healthy food choices in you know, in more affluent areas versus claims to health in inner city areas that are used. And one example we look at is a Frito-Lay campaign where they use the rhetoric of health to sell Fritos and Cheetos in inner city convenience stores. And the claim is basically, we've cut the number of Fritos and Cheetos in half in our bag. So this is a healthy alternative, and so we've lowered the price of these Cheetos to 25 cents. Sorry. And so in a way, there was a clear kind of socioeconomic argument being made, and a clear kind of, we found it to be incredibly problematic racially in a particular way that they were trying to make this campaign, but it was because they were using the rhetoric of health in a way that it did seem to fly under a particular radar.
Richard Klein has a really interesting essay in the book. He points out that obviously part of the reason that we eat and drink is for pleasure, but in our society today, we are trained to sort of justify that pleasure by always talking first about nutrition.
Right. No, and Klein's piece is a beautiful piece. He's the author of a pretty controversial book. He's a professor at Cornell, a romance studies scholar, who's written a book called Cigarettes Are Sublime. And he makes a similar argument to the one that I'm furthering now, which is that he says, on one hand, you know, the after effects of cigarettes are bad. On the other hand, we've oversimplified the matter by saying health good, cigarettes bad. What we forget is that cigarettes are in part addictive because of their chemical properties, but they're also addictive because they convey a certain kind of pleasure. That in a way, if we don't understand that people find cigarette smoking sensual, that we find cigarette smoking as a kind of, you know, age-old quest to conquer fire, as an idea about sexuality and warmth, that if we don't understand that about cigarette smoking, that we've oversimplified the issue, whatever side of the debate we fall on. And in his essay in this book, he extends that argument to the question of eating and looks at how we're so worried about calories that we've actually cut away our cultural vocabulary for talking about pleasure. So he actually argues for a return to pleasure.
Do you think part of the concern or part of the reason that we have done this is because if we can guarantee that we're doing things right, it's sort of there but for the grace of God go I. You know that these bad outcomes are not going to happen to you if you're in the kind of control that you see other people ceding.
Well, there is, of course, the fantasy that that's true. And again, I do think that it's a great thing. I mean, it's not like, again, we're arguing that we shouldn't have nutritional labels on food or we shouldn't try to hold corporations accountable for, you know, the content of their products, all these kind of advances of public health. We're very for those advances. But there are a few essays, for example, on pain management and on cancer in the book. And the cancer book was written by somebody who's writing a memoir who's experienced herself with cancer. And she says that, you know, that basically, on one hand, we love the idea that we can control everything by controlling our diet or our exercise. But if you actually look at the numbers, it tells a more kind of, I would call it depressing set of numbers, and that actually the things that could happen to you in terms of your health over the course of your life, about 5 or 6% of them are related to your diet and exercise, and about, you know, 90-something percent of them are actually a bit more out of our control because they're related to genetics or environment or other kinds of things. So in a way, the argument is that on one hand, taking control of our bodies is a good thing. On the other hand, it's a way of imposing for ourselves a form of control over a sense of anxiety about the lack of control.
Jonathan Metzl is my guest. He's Associate Professor of Psychiatry and Women's Studies and Director of the Program in Culture, Health, and Medicine at the University of Michigan. He is also co-editor of the new book, Against Health, How Health Became the New Morality. Join the conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Jonathan Metzl. He's Associate Professor of Psychiatry and Women's Studies and Director of the Program in Culture, Health, and Medicine at the University of Michigan. He is co-editor, along with Anna Kirkland, of the new book, Against Health, How Health Became the New Morality. Join our conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. I want to continue talking, Jonathan, about the chapter on cancer and cancer culture. It occurred to me that when we know someone who has lung cancer, the narrative always includes in telling that person's story to someone else, whether they smoked or whether they did not smoke. And somehow that frames the way an entirely, you know, third-party observer imagines this story.
No, that's certainly true. It's absolutely true that lung cancer is associated, of course, you know, lung cancer is associated with a series of, we might call them kind of blame claims about about the person's behavior, that they smoked, that they participated in certain unhealthy activities. You know, and again, it's a complex issue because on one hand, if you look back at the American popular culture in the 1950s, for example, where doctors were smoking in cigarette ads in medical journals, we've definitely come a long way as a culture in terms of recognizing the very pernicious impact of cigarette smoke on people's health. At the same time, there is a pretty deep kind of moral connection to that person deserved it or something like that, that comes along with certain cancer diagnoses. And what's complicated about that, for example, is that, you know, that the linear connection we have, even with, you know, smoking leading to lung cancer, of course smoking is, you know, leads to lung cancer, and I guess the numbers are about 25%, 30%, something like that. But it's conveyed with a kind of you deserve what you got kind of mentality that it is just, you know, what we want to point out is that's something that's very particular to our moment in time. And even if you went back 50 years ago, people would not have made that moral assumption. So it tells us something about, you know, our relationship to health and to the health industry in the present day. The other issue I should just say in that piece is that, again, the author is somebody who herself is a breast cancer survivor, and she's written about her complicated relationship between, it's Lachlan Jane at Stanford University. She writes about her complicated relationship to the kind of Lance Armstrong campaigns, which are kind of coding cancer in terms of a kind of athletic contest. And yeah, as she writes, it's complicated because on one hand, it's increasing awareness. At the same time, it makes you feel sometimes, if you're in, as she says, in that position, like if you succumb to cancer, you're a loser, almost like you've lost an athletic performance or lost a game or lost a race or something like that. And then she looks at the epidemiology of cancer and looks at the very, you know, frightening numbers about mortality and says that we have a lot of losers by that formulation. So again, it's not like she's for or against that, but the way it's coded, she feels, is something on one hand she can identify with, and on another hand she feels could be potentially stigmatizing.
Yeah, it's really interesting the way we sort of define one's ability to beat cancer. You know, when you hear about someone who has been diagnosed, you always give them these encouraging messages. And of course you want, you know, people to feel like they've got people behind them, but it's not always within one's control, or it's not only about one's attitude, what this disease does to the body.
Right. And again, you know, it's kind of similar to what we were talking about before, that in a way there is, of course, something very human and understandable about wanting to exert control over something that's uncontrollable. So if everything feels out of control and you feel like the one thing you can control is your diet or your stress level or something like that, that in a way, you know, there, of course, there's something very important about that message. Empowering people is a tremendously important psychological tool. And at the same time, you know, as she was saying, it's like we shouldn't go so far as to say that if you do all those things and you still have a negative outcome, that it means that somehow you didn't work hard enough or you didn't compete hard enough, which she feels is the message sometimes.
What's also interesting in the Lachlan Jane piece, when she wrote about the fact that people with cancer, on top of everything else, have to manage the fact that their disease makes others uncomfortable.
Right. I don't think that's a surprise to anyone. So it's also about managing other people's expectations. I mean, we were in a seminar a couple of weeks ago, and I was reading some other her work. She has a great book coming out probably next year, and it's like, you know, even mentioning the word cancer makes other people uncomfortable. So it's about managing other people's anxieties and expectations as well.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phones to John in Lakewood. Hi, John.
Yes, this is John. I was listening to the comment earlier that most of the serious impacts to our health are out of our control, and therefore that diet and exercise and taking care of our health is not always as important as we think. What I want to point out, I had a liver transplant and West Nile virus after the liver transplant. So I had two experiences that were totally out of my control that threatened my life seriously. I knew ahead of time, before the transplant, years ahead of time, that I had a liver condition, that it was life-threatening. And I always pursued diet and exercise and total health care for years. And I feel that although it certainly didn't prevent me from having to have a liver transplant, it didn't prevent me from getting West Nile. It made my ability to survive those much, much easier. A number of times, doctors have told me, you shouldn't be as healthy as you are with your condition. And when I survived the West Nile after the transplant, the doctor told me afterwards, only 1 in 7 transplant patients that get West Nile live to tell about it.
Wow.
And the ones that do oftentimes are bedridden for the rest of their life. I'm walking and talking. I do my own grocery shopping. I go to garage sales. I have to use a walker to walk. But because I'm convinced that because I've always been very energetic in pursuing my health and keeping it as well as I can, it enabled me to survive these experiences that some people don't.
Yeah, well, John, I'm glad you're doing well, and thank you so much for calling. Do you want to respond to that, Jonathan?
Well, absolutely. Let me first say that I think that that's wonderful, and I mean, congratulations. I think that that's very, very important, and I would never want anybody to come away from this interview or from reading our book thinking that we would be in any way critical of people like John. I think that that's a wonderful story, and certainly I think that it's absolutely true. I mean, let me be clear. I'm a physician. We have other physicians writing in the book. We have bioethicists. We have illness survivors and people who are very, very sensitive, hopefully, to these particular issues. And it certainly is true that taking control of an issue that seems totally out of your control is tremendously important. It's tremendously important. And we would not in any way want to be anything but celebratory of that. And that's absolutely the case. At the same time, you know, we're looking at some of the bigger issues about, you know, who defines health in a way that that may or may not play out in terms of people's individual experiences, but also look at the bigger political context about kind of health writ large in a particular way. I mean, one place we've certainly seen this recently is in the debate about healthcare. There are now debates kind of going on, I guess, between Sarah Palin and Michelle Obama about food intake and other kinds of issues. And even in the debates about the healthcare, it seemed like there were many different issues about what health meant and what health looked like that were coming from very different ideological positions. So people really couldn't agree, not just about like the financing of healthcare, but actually about who got health, who got healthy, and in cases like John's, you know, who had access to healthcare. I mean, who had the right to get a liver transplant, for example. And these are, on one hand, medical issues, but they're also moral, political, economic ones as well.
You know, John mentioned almost in passing the fact that he uses a walker. It sounds as if he feels very much like a healthy man today, thanks in part perhaps to the good care he's taken of his body. Talk for a minute. There's some really interesting writing in the book about attitudes toward disabled people who might have a loss of some kind of function, but otherwise sometimes are in very good health and likely to enjoy a normal health lifespan. And yet able-bodied people have a really difficult relationship sometimes to dealing with the disabled.
Right, and I invite people who don't know much about this issue to look both at the people writing in our book and at a bigger field that's emerging in the academy right now called disability studies, which looks at very directly questions of ability and the assumptions that are made about how somebody in a walker might look or feel versus the kind of disjuncture between that and how they might be experienced or kind of stigmatized or observed in popular culture. So that's certainly the case where, you know, somebody's identity and the way somebody might appear in culture are sometimes potentially at odds.
Yeah, there's this idea that maybe the big problem, the big impediment for people with disabilities is the attitudes of everybody else.
Right. Well, I think that's one thing that people, and actually people who write about obesity in our book make the same point, that in a way what they're trying to do is manage not just their own relationship to their body, but really about everybody else's expectations.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is Jonathan M. Metzl, editor of Against Health, How Health Became the New Morality. We'll go next on the phone to Matt in Dallas. Hi, Matt.
Hi. It's funny you were just talking about our attitudes towards people with disabilities, because my mother's been in very poor health for about 20 years or more, and I, on the other hand, am an avid yogi and, you know, eat mostly vegetarian, Ayurvedic, and that kind of thing. And I have a really hard time seeing her be in such poor health, but she also refuses to eat anything healthy like vegetables or anything like that, or do anything healthy for herself, or even just get up and move around, spend half of her life in bed. So I'm just curious what your opinion would be about, you know, how to deal with that within a family and you know, struggling with my attitude towards her about it.
Sure. Well, I mean, definitely, I think I'm pro eating vegetables, and I think I could go out on a limb and say that your mom should probably eat some more vegetables if she's not eating vegetables. I'm kind of in a similar boat, which is I'm not trying to be a hypocrite here. I'm somebody who's a fitness enthusiast as well. But I do think that it's important for us to think sometimes even generationally about changing attitudes about health. Now, I don't know the specifics of your case with your mom, but I will say that every generation, our ideas about healthy diet, healthy behavior, undergo tremendous change, right? And so your mom might be coming out of a cultural moment where our, you know, what are presented now as ideas about healthy diet are different. On one hand, you could say, well, she's not progressing with the times or something like that. But I do think that if we acknowledge that our ideas change over time about health, then I think it's an important question to say, what do our attitudes about health and behavior right now tell us about our particular moment? So, again, I'm not trying to argue against eating vegetables in any way. I happen to like vegetables a lot. But I would say that it's tied up not just in medical advice, but also about kind of attitudes about, what we might call ideology.
Joan Wolf writes here about the all-pervasive campaign to persuade mothers to breastfeed their babies. And her concern there is that the judgmental attitudes of breastfeeding advocates toward mothers who make other choices tends to oversimplify the science in support of breastfeeding. Now, she's not arguing against it, but she wants people to recognize there's more to it than this is good and this is bad.
Right. I mean, certainly, and for people who want to, Joan Wolf has just had an important book come out also from NYU Press, our publisher, and she talks about the politics of breastfeeding. And again, she's trying to kind of paint a similar fine line to the one I'm doing now, which is not to say people shouldn't breastfeed, but that we've gotten in a particular kind of cultural frenzy about the moral position about what it means to not breastfeed, that automatically, if you walk onto a public space or you see somebody on a bus or in a train, bottle feeding their infant, all of a sudden there's this cultural assumption, a kind of knee-jerk assumption that person is a bad mother because they're not breastfeeding, they're bottle feeding. And so it conveys all of these assumptions that, are tied up in knowledge about the importance of breastfeeding, but it's used to convey a certain kind of prejudice against women who might be bottle feeding, and what she argues is that we don't actually know why anybody may or may not bottle feed. It's certainly their choice to make that decision for their child, but also who knows? It could be medical or socioeconomic, but because we live in a particular medicalized society, it comes with a set of moral claims that Joan Wolf, who's in a law school in Texas, actually, is uncomfortable with.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. We have an email here that writes, I live with a life condition that is invisible to others. It was diagnosed by a blood test, treated every 3 weeks with a drug infusion. Yet because my hair hasn't fallen out or I don't use a wheelchair, many people think I'm a linger because I don't eat right or I don't take care of myself. It's an interesting perspective that we also have definitions about what you should look like if you are sick.
And the point is also, you know, kind of the opposite of what we were talking about in terms of the disability point, which is also that there's, in a way, an invisibility, too, which is that if you're sick, exactly, you should look a particular way or you should act a particular way.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Back to the phones now. This time we'll speak with Marsha in Brushy Prairie. Hi, Marsha.
Hi. I'm wondering if the doctor's research has uncovered any prejudice on the part of the medical profession.
Oh, yeah.
Against those people who do not live a healthy lifestyle. I ask because I'm a smoker. And years ago, I had a ruptured disc, but I didn't know it was a ruptured disc. I had to go to 4 different doctors to get a referral to a back surgery. I would go, I would pay the $300 for all the tests, and they would tell me to quit smoking.
What do you know about that, Jonathan?
Well, I really invite people to read the book, because I'll just say to Marsha that we really are, hopefully what people would agree is, very critically engaged with the medical establishment, again, of which I'm a part and other people in the book are a part. But I guess the point we try to make in the book is that even though we have a fantasy that this might be true, that doctors live in American culture. They live in American society, and they at times embody the value judgments of the culture in which they're coming from. And so stigmatizing people because of certain actions certainly influences their decision-making process. We haven't talked about it a lot in this discussion. Maybe we can after the break, but we also talk a lot about the pharmaceutical industry in the book, and the kind of complex relationship between medicalization and the pharmaceutical industry, all of which have particular claims in defining health in one way and not another. So again, we're not saying that people like Marsha shouldn't go to the doctor. It sounds like there was an important intervention that happened. But that doctors, too, are part of American culture, and that, you know, that in a way we should look at the complex ways that health is defined, not just in society, but in the medical context as well.
Jonathan M. Metzl is Associate Professor of Psychiatry and Women's Studies and Director of the Program in Culture, Health, and Medicine at the University of Michigan. He is also co-editor of the new book, Against Health, How Health Became the New Morality. Join the conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Jonathan M. Metzl. He's Associate Professor of Psychiatry and Women's Studies and Director of the Program in Culture, Health, and Medicine at the University of Michigan. He's co-editor of the new book of essays, Against Health, How Health Became the New Morality. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So you sort of teased this for us before the break, Jonathan. Let's talk about the pharmaceutical industry, which lots of people need drugs to feel well and healthy. Clearly, they do some good, but they have also created several categories of human existence, which are now defined as disease and might not have been in the past.
No, that's certainly the case. And again, it's complicated. I'm a psychiatrist, and certainly I think that I'm a strong proponent of the pharmaceutical industry and of the impact of certain medications part of an important treatment. At the same time, the work that I've done in this book, but also in the books that I've written before this, I have a book called Prozac on the Couch and a book called Protest Psychosis. Both came out before this, and they're pretty critical at times about the relationship between the pharmaceutical industry and medicine and psychiatry and the impact on cultural categories or even medical categories of illness and health. I'm sure we can think of different examples of this kind of process in the present day. I mean, one that comes to mind for me is restless leg syndrome, for example, a small category that then we kind of got a medical treatment for, many advertisements on television. All of a sudden, it's an enormous category. Other kinds of conditions where You know, we go from small illness categories to ones that are tremendously vast and expansive. In the book, people talk about, Chris Lane has a wonderful piece about passive-aggressive personality disorder. Carl Elliott, a bioethicist, writes about pharmaceutical marketing more broadly. And the point is that there are powerful forces of medicalization that are trying to expand illness categories outward, but also health categories, to say if you move your legs in your sleep, you might have a medical illness, and you take this drug so you can become healthy. And what we say is that there are strong commercial interests in defining categories of illness and health in television, on television advertisements, and direct-to-consumer ads and magazines. And so the question is, like, how can we, fight back is what comes to mind, but it's more like, how can you have a debate that looks at that pretty critically? Because certainly one thing that's true is that there's never been more of a kind of presence of pharmaceutical advertising in the history of American advertising than there has at present, in terms of helping us define what illness and health means. And it's in part a medical position, but it's also strongly a commercial one.
Well, let's go back to the restless leg thing. And I have nothing against people who want help if they're waking up all night or they're kicking their partners or whatever. But when you say you might have a medical condition, this thing called restless leg syndrome, take this drug and you'll become healthy. What it really implies there is take this drug and you will become normal.
Right, absolutely. In the first book that I did, the Prozac on the Couch, I looked at the history of antidepressant advertisements. And what I argue in that book is that there is a strong correlation in the advertisements between health and normalcy. And that's not a new argument. It's probably not surprising to people. But what I looked at in that book were the presence of wedding rings and mothers in images, in pharmaceutical ad images, of women who had gotten treatment with SSRI antidepressants. And what I kind of argued in that book was that there was a very strong correlation between being mentally healthy and being a normal mother. Now, you could say, well, that's something we agree with, but in a way, what these ads were subtly arguing was, if you were a bad mother, you might need some Prozac, or if you were a bad wife or something. So that's certainly something that's at play in a lot of advertisements. And the question is, is it possible to step outside of that economy when we're really bombarded with these advertisements all of the time?
There's also this new category of sexual health, and sex is a very important part of a lot of people's lives. But things like erectile dysfunction, there are people who are made to feel as if they cannot be normal and a complete man if they haven't treated it.
No, I think anybody watching the Viagra phenomenon over the course of the past year and 10 years, it's another example of what I was talking about the expansion of a particular category. Now, when Viagra first came out, it was very tightly controlled and regulated and even marketed as a medication, well, first as an anti-hypertensive medication, but then as a medication just for elderly people who might be having sexual problems because of medical conditions. And if you look at early Viagra ads, for example, it really was just elderly men in these advertisements. And what happened over time was a process that called in critical circles diagnostic bracket creep, which is an expansion in almost not just the use of the drug, but our understanding of the illness, to the point where now we've got Viagra race cars and this assumption about 4-hour erections. And, you know, in a way, it creates a new category of not just of illness, but of what is normal, that's driven in part by medical science, but also by pharmaceutical advertising and marketing and other kind of forces.
Well, that's so interesting, because I think some of the early ads were done by Bob Dole, and
right.
now a lot of them have somebody who looks like the Old Spice guy sort of bounding into the office after a great night. It's a totally different thing.
Yeah, and Bob Dole would have a hard time getting on the ads now, I think. I mean, and it is marketed in a very different way, and of course that goes hand in hand with a shifting market share. And again, not that that's a good or bad thing. I mean, sometimes medications, even medications like Prozac, come out, and then we figure out what they're good for just through the course of using them. But there's a process that's expanding these categories of illness and health. And, you know, what we try to say in the book is it's in part about medicine, but it's also about ideology and commerce and all these other factors. And it leaves people with very little ability to fight back in a particular way, because you're so saturated in this culture with these particular health messages. So in a way, one of the things we talk about is how it's almost like you're seen as crazy if you try to protest the medical establishment or protest against health messages because they're so very pervasive.
We have, we'll go back to the phones now. This time we'll speak with Paul in Arlington. Hi, Paul.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Thanks for having me.
Sure.
You've mostly answered the question I was going to pose. I want to say I'm really enjoying this conversation today.
Thank you.
And the question I was going to present was just how much of being, quote-unquote, healthy, be it spiritually or physically or mentally for that matter, is purely societally driven, whether being unhealthy is being bald, so you need Rogaine or laser hair removal or whatever it seems like is being societally accepted at the time as being healthy and correct. How much of that, how do we get away from that and to a point where we actually understand what is real health in terms of all of those things? I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for your call.
Well, thank you so much. That's an absolutely wonderful question. And I guess I want to give two responses. One is that it's always going to be a negotiation. So it's always a negotiation between kind of medicine and culture and society and personal expectation about how we define health. It's both a cultural pressure and it's a very personal issue as well. And so there's always going to be a particular kind of negotiation that happens. But I do think that, again, it's hard. I mean, the caller was just saying, how do we get away from that or step outside of that? And I present that to listeners of this program as being an open question because I think it's a very complicated question. Is it possible to step outside of these messages? And how do you do it when we ingest them from culture, but we also internalize them for better or worse? And I guess the point I would just make is that it's increasingly harder to get outside of that particular system. And certainly that's true with, Rogaine and Viagra and kind of obvious examples. But what we try to argue in the book is that it's also that there are also profound cultural pressures that impact and play on people with seemingly more straightforward illnesses like cancer or chronic pain or hypertension.
Well, I'm assuming that I'm correct in my assumption that there was never any convention of doctors or of even drug companies where they said, let's find a way to use medicine as a form of social control. So how did it happen?
Well, actually, funny you should mention that the book that I just finished was called the Protest Psychosis, and it looks at the use of antipsychotic medications in the 1960s and 1970s, particularly to convey a form of social control. what I look at in that book is actually black power protesters and civil rights protesters in the 60s and 70s mm-hmm. who were represented in pharmaceutical advertisements as being people in need of control with antipsychotic medication.
Wow.
And so I would say that I actually think I do have pretty compelling evidence in that book for the ways in which medicine actually is used as a form of social control. And we can think about extreme examples of that kind of dynamic in other cultures as well. I mean, China comes to mind today, for example, but also in the Soviet Union and diagnosis and treatment being used to control dissident-type behavior and protests. And the question is that just something that's happening in these extreme examples, or is there a way in which, you mentioned the word power before, but are there kind of social controls, maybe not about controlling political protests, but about, social pressures, the way the last caller was talking about, that are conveyed through the rhetoric of biomedicine. And again, we're not against medicine, but what we're saying is that it's important to look at the power function of health discourse because it is, in many ways, a normalizing discourse that does exert pressures on people even as it attempts to help them.
We have an email here from someone who writes about experiencing varying but usually severe social phobia and agoraphobia, cannot very often even get out to do things. And this person writes, can you imagine the few times I managed to ride a wave of coinciding meds and easing of phobias, how to explain to people? People will say, well, if you're so phobic, why are you here now? Which often drives me back in. Very few people understand. Almost all judge harshly and negatively.
Yeah, that's wonderful. I mean, because the flip side of what we're talking about, so before in our conversation we talked about obvious kind of smoking or other kinds of aesthetic behavior, but the flip side of that is people who actually suffer from conditions that we code as being medicalized or false. Things like social phobia, for example, or even like people who use Rogaine, the caller before was saying, or something. But in a way, medicalization also makes it hard to talk about the genuine suffering sometimes that people experience, because there is a cultural assumption that these things are boutique-y or false or construction. So it definitely goes both ways. I really appreciate that message.
So it's really easy for us to sit here and talk about how everyone else judges, but what does it take to sort of turn all this inward and examine our own assumptions, things that we may not even realize, biases that we might have?
Right. So in the end of the book, actually, my co-author Anna Kirkland writes that kind of really, I think, brilliant conclusion about the steps forward that we need to kind of address. And part of those steps that she talks about are personal in a way, which is that we can't really critique health or even support health until we understand the very complex ways in which the category of health operates in American society. And I know I mentioned this before, but certainly we've seen this recently with the healthcare debate, or with these really crazy debates now about school lunches and the kind of Sarah Palin, Michelle Obama type debates about obesity. That in a way, you know, what she's arguing and what I think many of the authors are arguing is, if we oversimplify health, we can't see how health is an incredibly charged ideological and political position that people might not agree about. And so we looked through the kind of healthcare debate, and what we said was, in a way, we thought people were in part obviously disagreeing about finance, but they were also disagreeing about what is healthy, who has the right to health, who has the right to healthcare. So part of that is we need to recognize the politics of health if we hope to intervene. And then to create new forms of coalition, new forms of action in a way. So in a way, the first step is, in a very academic way, or maybe a very psychiatric way, recognizing what the problem is, and then thinking about new coalitions that, again, don't reject Western medicine, but that might help us fight back against the pervasive messages that are coming from culture and from advertisements and even from within ourselves about the ideology of health.
Do we need to be careful of putting too much faith in science, or in today's science?
Well, certainly we should have a critical conversation. You know, we're not trying to be Luddites and say people shouldn't take medications, or we should, you know, smash the fMRI machines that are looking into our brains in new and important ways. But, for example, if you look at brain scans, there really is a cultural gap between what scientists will tell us we know from brain scans and the kind of ways that culture, you know, expands that message in a particular way to say we can learn everything about people's brains and we don't need to talk to anybody anymore. Anything like that. So certainly that's always going to be a tension. And of course, science itself is very ideological. And so we know that from history, and certainly it's true in the present day.
The new book, edited by Jonathan M. Metzl and Anna Kirkland, is called Against Health, How Health Became the New Morality. Jonathan, it's been a really interesting hour. Thank you so much for spending it with us.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed this very much.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
The Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.